The railway platforms were wet from the passengers' shoes and their shaken umbrellas. The whole day seemed weighted under a subdued gray damp. Railway workers moved around in their dark boredom. A new symphony was being piped through the loudspeakers, some factory drill of cello and violin. I took a bench under the platform eaves and watched as a woman my age bid goodbye to two teenage children. I smoothed my dress, neither too solemn nor celebratory, trying all the time to imagine what he would look like. My mother had sent me a photograph taken years before, while she was still teaching him in Ufa. He had the thin, cheeky face of a peasant boy, high Tatar cheekbones, sandy hair, a cocked stare. But he was 17 now and would surely look different. She said he was extraordinary, and I would recognize him immediately. He would stand out from the crowd. He had even turned walking into a sort of art. When the train finally arrived, pouring steam into the air, I stood and held out a hat that had once belonged to my father, a prearranged signal. It was patently absurd, but I felt a vague thrill, waiting for a boy half my age to emerge out of the day. I scanned the crowd, but nobody matched his description. Walking through, I brushed against summer overcoats and suitcases, even went so far as to hail two young boys who, in their fear, thought I was an official and hurriedly showed me their papers. The next train was not for another 4 hours, so I went out into a light rain. In front of the station, someone had altered the face of Stalin, chipping out tiny, almost imperceptible pox in the stone cheeks. The flowers beneath the statue had gone untended. The statue's defacement was foolish, of course, if not outright dangerous, but it was shortly before the 56th Congress, and we could already feel the thaw in Leningrad. It was as if a tiny crack had opened and light was spilling through, a cumulative light that would continue to spread, its existence becoming an undeniable fact of our lives. Black canvas tents stood over the tram tracks where they were being repaired. The price of radios had fallen. Shipments of oranges from Morocco were getting through. We hadn't seen oranges in years. Buyers pushed at one another down by the Nivaz docks. Just a few months before, in an attempt to resuscitate desire, I had been able to buy my husband 8 bottles of his favorite Georgian wine. We even had hot water piped into the apartment, and very late one night I had slipped into the bath with him, surprising myself. Him even more so. For a while, Iosif had brightened considerably, but when he finished the wine, he revisited his policy of gloom. Instead of waiting outside the station, I walked along the Neva, past the prison, down to the bridge, where I took a tram to the university. I rapped on my husband's door to inform him of the situation, but he wasn't in his office, probably working somewhere or dallying with one of the other physics professors. It was my first visit back to the university in quite a while, and there was a hollowness to the corridors as if I were walking through the belly of a drum that once formed the musical centerpiece of my life. I even toyed with the idea of going into the linguistics department, but I felt that it might rekindle old wounds, not salve them. Instead, I dug an old pass out of the depths of my bag and put my finger over the expiration date so I could get into the canteen. The food was grimier and more insipid than I remembered. The ladies behind the counter regarded me with a sort of disdain, and a man with a giant broom pushed bits of food and rubbish around the floor, moving slowly as if contemplating the deep mysteries of his sloth. Feeling like an intruder into my former life, I left. Outside, the sun had broken through the clouds, and reefs of Arctic light lay on the sky.